for more than 200 years, before Moscow was the seat of power, St. Petersburg was the resplendent capital of the Russian Empire. And it was here that the Romanov family established a tradition of luxury high-end items like imperial porcelain and Fabergé. We are in the Shuvalov Palace, one of the most sophisticated architectural monuments of St. Petersburg. It has witnessed numerous milestone events and hosted countless historic personalities within its walls. Now it is home to the largest private collection of the Fabergé Easter eggs in the world. Thank you for taking the time to meet us here. It's beautiful, beautiful setting. So Fabergé, he actually was known for making jewelry and exquisite interior items, but he really became famous because of these imperial eggs. Can you tell me how that all got started?
Traditionally, Easter was the main religious holiday, and Easter eggs were a traditional gift. It was Carl Fabergé, however, who was the first to offer a precious jewelry egg as an Easter surprise. The idea was so novel and became so popular that many aristocrats snapped them up, and people began to buy their Easter surprise gifts from Fabergé.
Each egg is its own unique creation. Can you talk to me a little bit about the process of how they were created? Was Fabergé given free rein to do anything that he wanted, or were there basic guidelines or rules that he had to follow?
It took about a year to create one egg, sometimes up to 3 years. Fabergé had free rein to pursue his creativity. The process would begin at the round table in Fabergé's office, where artists and designers would discuss their ideas for a new Easter masterpiece. Goldsmiths, silversmiths, gemstone cutters, and enamelers joined the discussions later. We know for a fact that it was teamwork. Each Easter creation was completed under the supervision of one master jeweler, who was responsible for every step of the process. However, Carl Fabergé remained the chief jeweler. He always had the last word.
Mm-hmm. Now, many people think of Fabergé as the man who did all of the work, but he was more of a businessman, like Tiffany in the United States. He brought a lot of artists under one roof. Why do we know the name Fabergé, but we do not know any of the individual craftsmen?
In his only interview responding to a journalist who compared him to Tiffany and Cartier, Carl Fabergé said, "They're only salesmen, not artists and jewelers." It's true that Carl Fabergé was a gifted entrepreneur and capable manager, but at the same time, he was no less talented as an artist, jeweler, and even psychologist. That collection of personal traits helped him gather a team of brilliant craftsmen at the time, such as Eric Collin, Michael Perchin, Henrik Widstrom, etc. We see their hallmarks on Fabergé jewelry next to the company's own mark, so we know about those masters. We are well aware of the famous artist and jeweler Alma Peel. She came up with a design known as the snowflake theme and is credited with designing the winter and the mosaic eggs. We also know the names of many miniature painters, such as Vasily Zuyev or Johann Zengraf.
How many craftsmen would it take to work on one individual egg?
I can't tell you the exact number of craftsmen who worked on each individual Easter egg, but we do know that it was a team effort involving dozens of people, starting from designers and artists down to enamelers, goldsmiths, and silversmiths.
Mm-hmm. Now, the hen egg is maybe the most modest, the most simple of the eggs. It was the one that started everything. Can you tell me the story about this specific egg?
The hen egg was inspired by a similar jewelry masterpiece, the so-called Wilhelmina egg, which was created in the early 1700s in France. It belonged to the parents of Empress Maria Fyodorovna, King Christian IX of Denmark, and Queen Louise. When Emperor Alexander III ordered the hen egg from Fabergé, he was trying to give the empress something that would remind her of her home country, which she missed a lot. Fabergé didn't make an exact replica, of course. He created his own elegant variation on the theme of an Easter surprise.
Mm-hmm. Now, each egg after that increasingly became more ornate, more fantastic. How did it become a tradition of just a simple egg into jewel-encrusted fantasy worlds, each in of themselves?
Empress Maria Fyodorovna loved the hen egg so much that a tradition of annual Easter surprises from Fabergé emerged in 1885. It's true that over time, the eggs became more sophisticated and more ornate. However, you can't say that Fabergé eggs are diamond-encrusted. The amount of gemstones or precious materials used for an Easter egg didn't matter to Fabergé. His main objective was always to showcase the skills of his jewelers and artists.
Now, what's the most expensive egg that you have in your collection here?
They're all priceless objects of Russian cultural heritage. It's impossible to single out any one piece.
Now, officially, there were 50, as you were telling me earlier, of these eggs. Some of them have been lost. Is there any chance of them being recovered? Is there any hope that they will someday be found?
Yes, researchers are still hopeful that one day they'll be able to recover those lost Easter creations. It has become a lifelong endeavor for some of them.
Now, if they are ever found, we know that the Fabergé logo is the two-headed eagle, much like Russia, that is used for authenticity. But in a day and age where anything can be fabricated or faked, how can we know that a Fabergé egg is really a Fabergé egg?
Yes, the two-headed eagle is a hallmark that you can see on Fabergé pieces. However, it was used by all suppliers of the imperial court, and Fabergé was one of them from 1885. Apart from the two-headed eagle, a Fabergé creation should also feature the seal of the company as well as other hallmarks, such as the material used, the year of manufacture, and even the place where the jewelry piece was crafted. At different times, there were different rules for jewelry marking. They evolved over time. Today, experts can distinguish between fakes and originals by looking for a specific set of hallmarks. Experts also use archives and documents in their work.
So we know that there are 10 eggs in Moscow. There are 9 eggs here, one at the Hermitage, and some in private collections as well. Is there any hope that you have to bring them all into one place under one roof in the same collection?
The Fabergé Museum collection is self-sufficient, so the Length of Times Foundation, which is in charge of the museum, does not pursue the objective to expand its collection of Easter eggs right now.
When porcelain first arrived in Europe from China, people desperately tried to work out how it was so durable. They came up with all sorts of concoctions, like mixing eggshells with crushed barnacles and burying it underground for almost a century. We're at the legendary Imperial Porcelain Factory, which is going to share some of its centuries-old secrets with us. Ludmila, thank you for taking the time for showing us what you do here. It's believed that fine bone china was actually invented here specifically at this place. What makes your recipe so special?
The secret of bone china is the use of cattle bone powder as one of the ingredients.
How many steps does it take to, like, make this cup right here? How many steps in the process does it take?
Up to 80.
Really? Can you talk to me about some of those steps?
First, we make a model, which is then used to create a gypsum mold. We pour porcelain into the mold and let it sit.
All right.
Then we open it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a part of a complete piece. What makes our work so complex is that we make each part separately. The handle here is cast separately and glued onto the piece later. It is comprised of two parts. After that, the piece is left to dry. This is followed by the first firing, glazing, the second firing, and transportation, which is another stage of the process. Then there's different types of decorating, and finally, polishing.
So many different steps in the entire process.
Yes, many different stages.
So basically, it's all so intricately connected. I know that it has to be fired at a high temperature. Why do we need such high temperatures for this to come out this way?
A high temperature is crucial for China. Every additional piece that's needed can only be fixed in place by firing. And each firing serves a distinct purpose. This is a dry piece. It must be done during the first firing before it can be glazed. The temperature at this stage is about 900 degrees. It makes the piece harder and opens up its pores, which makes it possible to apply glaze or do underglaze painting. There are many nuances here. Firing makes china whiter and stronger, so it is literally born in a kiln.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that this fine porcelain has to be white. It actually has to be a little bit translucent. How do you get that quality in your chinaware?
You can achieve that by adding more kaolin and by using a specific firing technique. These are the two components. If you have the right kaolin content and the right firing process, your chinaware will be white and translucent. You can see it here if you hold it against the light.
Mm-hmm. Interesting difference there. Now, I also hear that real porcelain sings. Can you tell me what that means?
Let me show you.
Mm-hmm.
Each piece has its own tone. It's like the porcelain sings.
Definitely has that unique sound. I've also heard that this type of porcelain is really the most eco-friendly. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. I'll explain why. It's because we use natural components and extreme heat. Everything is very eco-friendly, especially if you use underglaze paints.
Mm-hmm. So natural elements are in here. What kind of elements do you have?
The mix includes 40 ingredients. I can't list them all, but they include kaolin, silica, magnesite, and others. There are many of them, and each should be used in the right amount.
And just a little bit of bone in there as well.
40% bone, sure.
Once something has been poured, taken from the mold, and then it's fired, it's called a biscuit. Why is it called a biscuit? What exactly is that?
A biscuit piece is a finished product. It's just that it's matted and not glazed. Like this bird, for example. We typically use this finish for sculptures. Here, you can clearly see each feather and every detail. It's like marble. Compare it with this piece. This one is glazed, and this one is a biscuit piece.
So there are many legends that surround porcelain. For example, it's believed that if you put poison into a porcelain cup, that it will actually break and it won't hold the poison. Is this true? And do you have any special legends or stories about porcelain that are your favorites?
It's true. If you pour poison in the china, the piece will change color. It's best to use it for coffee and tea. It will taste better.
If we get right to it, I have to ask, you have this white piece of porcelain in front of you. It's a blank canvas. Are you allowed to just do whatever you want as an artist, or is there a set form that you have to follow, or do you know in advance what you're going to paint?
It depends. Porcelain is a unique, magical material. There's a reason people call it white gold. It really looks great when it's white. And that's also when its shape has the most striking effect. Both the whiteness and the outline of the piece make a statement. However, it also works great with different painting techniques. Sometimes you're given a specific task. That's when your job is to help expand the product range and you need to follow the specific instructions sent by the marketing team. There are also pieces which you decorate according to your own preferences and inspirations. This exhibition, for instance, took me a long time to put together. A lot of planning went into it, and my designs emerged as I was trying to imagine the collection as a whole. Naturally, it's hard to have a marketing plan for such free-form porcelain art, and it is unlikely that someone would want to order something like that.
Now, I know that cobalt net is a very popular pattern. Why is it so popular? Because it just doesn't seem to decrease in its popularity.
First, the cobalt net design replicates the motifs of Empress Elizabeth's first royal service. It was called Sobstvenny, the Empress's own, because it was made specially for her. It was the first imperial service produced by us during the lifetime of the founder of the manufactory, Empress Elizabeth. The original design was a gold mesh with pink flowers at the intersections. Here we use cobalt, and that's the second reason. Cobalt is a traditionally recognized material for the imperial porcelain manufactory. Blue and gold are the signature colors of St. Petersburg and our symbols.
Now, porcelain, is it actually a good medium for you as an artist? Is it inspire creativity?
You know, I've worked for the imperial porcelain manufactory for a long time, and porcelain has never been an easy material for me, but it's become my only medium. I even have a free verse poem where I write that I work with porcelain and porcelain works with me. We have a mutually enriching relationship. It's become the only constant in my artistic career. I'm grateful for the limitless opportunities it can give me as an artist.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you have master classes here. Do you mind if I give it a try?
Let's give it a try.
So as I understand it, and as I'm getting the feel of this, it's very difficult to work with. And I've heard that working with porcelain requires a certain skill set. Why is it so difficult to work with?
What makes it difficult is that you need a certain level of precision and feel for the texture of the paint. On the one hand, porcelain is smooth and it allows for corrections. You can wipe something off, as we did just then, make a correction and start again. But that's talking about overglaze decoration, which we are doing right now. When you do underglaze painting, though, you need to have extraordinary skill because when porcelain does not have a layer of glaze on, it's very porous and absorbs paint immediately. You need to be an accomplished master in order to apply paint with precision, with the right thickness, at exactly the right spot, according to the design, and make it look nice as well. You do need a lot of experience to work with porcelain.
I have to ask kind of an esoteric question. Artificial intelligence, computers, they're taking all of the attention from artists these days. Do you see in the future, maybe artificial intelligence taking over your work as an artist here?
I hope it's not going to happen. This handicraft and awe that an artist feels when working with porcelain are irreplaceable. That's what I believe.
And what you do here, it's a part of history. It's a part of, it's a part of Russian culture. Are you proud of what you do? Does it bring you joy?
It does, of course. Otherwise, I wouldn't have worked for the Imperial Porcelain Manufactory for so long. When I bring guests to our museum, which is now a branch of the Hermitage Museum, it's always a breathtaking experience for me because I know that our porcelain has captured the whole of Russian history. Being a part of this history and culture is a great responsibility, but it's also something to be proud of.
Thank you for taking the time to show me how to do this, and it's been a fascinating day. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest and willingness to give porcelain making a try.